It's time once again for Dialogue Conspiracy with political research specialist Mae Brussel, who for 5 years has shared with us her extensive research into political assassinations and abuses of power in this country. Her program relates the news of the week to emerging evidence about the conspiracy which allegedly maintains by force its control over the legislative, executive, and judicial processes in America. And now, Mae Brussel.
Good afternoon. This is Mae Brussel in Carmel, California. This is Dialogue Conspiracy, number 265, and it's April 18th, 1977. I want to make a few comments about mail. If you write me letters to the house or to the station, my address is in the telephone book if you have questions. And I am getting a lot of mail, and please forgive me for the delay. I'm answering questions as fast as I can or copying articles for you. And it does take a while because I have a pile on my desk that's about 3 months behind. Send me a self-addressed envelope made out to yourself and stamped with a simple question. Cut the information short. If you have something to tell me, make it as concise as you can so that I can read it quickly, because I really am backlogged in the mail. It's really a problem to answer it now. And I'll give you the titles of books or where you can get information, such as the address of the Labor Caucus, the book on the Trilateral Commission. I get a lot of questions, and I can answer them for you, but I can do it very fast when the envelope is made out, and I don't have to sit and copy it over. So do that, and I'll answer your questions. I also get a lot of questions about tapes of the shows, and I have a little form made out, and I'll tell you how to get them if you want them. You can send reels. They're 1,800 feet for the reels, and we'll copy the shows. The cost of copying the shows is $2, and the postage, if you want a first class, is $1.65. If you want to wait, it's about 24 cents, if you don't care how long it takes to get there. Send your blank tapes, and it's $3.65, $2 to copy, and $1.65 for the postage. The least expensive way of getting a copy of the shows is tape cassettes, and many, many people now are sending me blank cassettes so that I don't have to go out and purchase them and keep track of the purchases for tax records and so forth. The cassettes have to be 90 minutes, 40 minutes on each side. And again, send an envelope and put your address on there and the postage. The postage is 24 cents. If you have a cassette with no box in it, it's 36 cents if you want the box that goes with the tape cassette. If you want them each week, I'll send it out each week as quickly as I can, and the backside will be blank, but you can return it and fill it in with another show. All you have then is a duplication of the postage, and you can have the tape much quicker. And I am able to get them out now. If it keeps up that I have too many to copy, I'll have to take them somewhere and have them multiple copied. But I am able to get them out within 2 or 3 days, keeping 2 machines going. And if you want tape cassettes of any particular show that you missed, I got a letter last week on 2 shows on mind control. I got another one on Carter and the Trilateral Commission, another one on George DeMorenchild, the specific shows that people want. Put on the tape cassette what you want in terms of either the number of the show or the date or the subject matter and the approximate date. Put it right on the tape. Put it in an envelope. Address it to yourself, and I'll get them out as fast as I can. The books coming out now on conspiracies, various murders, and the government malfunctioning in terms of justice and investigations is so long that I can hardly run down the list of new books. I may do a show on that next week or in 2 weeks to let you know what kind of books are coming out. I have book lists if you want to send an addressed envelope, a bibliography of suggested books to read. And my book list was made out about a year ago, of very good basic books. But if you want new books, you can write to Aries Arts in Capitola and ask for a list of books on the assassinations and conspiracies, and they have a complete list of books, most complete list of books that I know on assassinations and conspiracies. That's in Capitola, California, and ask for their book list on this subject. Just about 2 more announcements now, and then we'll get on to some more conspiracy information. I am going to be speaking at UC Santa Cruz this week on Thursday night. I haven't been up there for quite a while. Last time I was at Merrill College. The university is broken up into small colleges. I'm going to be at Cowell College, and it's not going to be a formal lecture. I'm going to take questions. I don't have questions and answers on Dialogue Conspiracy, but I will be there The meeting will be about 7:30 or 8 o'clock at Cowell College, UC Santa Cruz. And that's this Thursday, April the 21st. And I'll be able to answer many questions. You won't have to write me a letter. If you want to go up there, the people that listen at Santa Cruz will have a chance to meet with me, and we can go over some of these matters. And then one other announcement for people in the local area in Carmel or Pacific Grove, Santa Cruz, Salinas area. My favorite movie, one of my favorite movies on investigations, is called The Borgia Stick. It's named after a family in Italy, the Borgia family, and the stick is a cane. It's just a symbolic piece of equipment in the movie, so the title is deceptive. The movie was made in 1967, and it's rerun almost as often as Citizen Kane. It isn't as good as Citizen Kane, but the material is very pertinent. And it's going to be on television Friday night, 8 o'clock, Channel 2. I always open the TV guide on Sundays, hoping to catch the Borgia stick to announce it on time on KLRB for people that listen. It's the story of a husband and wife who live in the suburbs and come home from work and they're cars and close the door. And when they get inside the house, they are not husband and wife at all, but they are agents of the intelligence community. And it tells how they do their jobs for the Security Exchange Commission, for the CIA, and how their jobs involve following people in various crimes. And they're guaranteed a passport and a lot of money to be flown out of the country after their last assignment when agents were killed. And when they get their passport in the car, this husband and wife agent, who are actually both agents of the CIA, the intelligence community, they refer to their jobs as being part of the company. They see the passport picture doesn't resemble their faces, and they're told that they just have one more stop at a private hospital. It's a large estate, and they'll have a little bit of surgery, a little bit of marking on their face, and some fingerprint removal and transplants or removal of their prints, fingerprints, and then they'll be on their way with this large fortune, and they can escape and leave the country. And their surgery will be similar to the passport pictures. So they go into this hospital, and they go into surgery, and before they do, they're in the back courtyard, and they see another agent. They used to work with them, and the wife is visiting, and he's had a lobotomy, and he's reduced to a vegetable state with no mind at all, and his head's wrapped up. And this couple are taken then into the surgery room, and their minds are erased. The government takes back their money, and they put them on the funny farm, and that is where they end after they serve their country. It's a very important movie. I talked about it with this particular gentleman who called me about 3 months ago. I told you who had done assassinations for the CIA, the one who was attacked when he wanted to quit the job of killing people for them, and they tried to murder him, and he's out trying to get even right now, as he says, with vengeance for their attempts to kill him and for the jobs they wanted him to do. And I brought up the subject of the Borgia stick, and he said this is absolutely true, that the CIA often kill their agents after they've done jobs, and they also do this kind of surgery on them, and it keeps other people in line who might talk, and it's a very good living reminder of the way the agency can handle people. It keeps you on your toes. And I was told that this kind of surgery does happen. He said it happened to a good friend of his who was in Vietnam and came home, and they took him and did a lobotomy. They're not complicated operations. You don't have to do much on the skull. You can go through the eyes and pierce a part of the brain and do a surgical lobotomy right through the lid of the eye, underneath the lid. So this very instructive movie, and it is an instructive movie starring Don Murray, is Friday night, 8 o'clock, Channel 2. And for those of you who aren't in the area, watch your TV guides if you're back east or midwest or wherever, north and south. Watch your TV guide and look for the Borgia stick and see when it comes to your town and check it off. And you'll find it's a very instructive movie, and according to somebody in the agency, it still continues. I got a letter last week, typical of the kind of mail I get, with a question referring to a program I had a long time ago on what was the name of the drug that was given to people in the prisons in Chile, and then these people were released from prison, and the drug causes their bladder to shrivel up, and 3 years or so from now, they will die, and the Chilean government will not be blamed for their death. They'll have a bladder disease. This article on the kind of drug that is administered was from the New England Medical Journal, July 1975. It was repeated in the Earth News October 29th, 1975. For those of you who want to look this up, you might find the original copy and send me the full article, the New England Medical Journal. The name of the drug is cyclophosphamide, cyclophosphamide. Cyclophosphamide. It's for political prisoners in Chile who were given drugs that cause their bladder to shrivel up, and then the bladder will cease functioning and will cause death in a few years. The prisoners were released. They will die at home, and the government will not be blamed for their death. This isn't just happening in Chile in July 75. This has been going on, it seems, for a long time in the government, and it's been a standard operating procedure, maybe not the same drug, but the same kinds of techniques. As a matter of fact, my coworker who is working with me on the Howard Hughes book called me this morning, and he was reading the book called The Great Conspiracy. Another friend turned us on to this book. It's a fantastic book written by Michael Sayers. It was put out in 1936, and I had to order it from a book organization that locates hard-to-find books. Somebody in Washington, D.C. located this for me. But in the book, The Great Conspiracy, they talk about Woodrow Wilson, who was president of the United States during World War I and wanted to form the League of Nations. And he was in Paris to sign the Versailles Treaty, which was the treaty that stated that Germany could not rearm again to start another war in Europe after the Holocaust of World War I. And Woodrow Wilson also believed that the USSR, the new Soviet government, should be included in the League of Nations. He said, we will never get off the ground unless they're part of it. And he wanted the Soviet government to be included in the League of Nations. And in the book, The Great Conspiracy, there's a quotation of Major Herbert Yardley from another book, The American Black Chamber. And it says that the espionage system that existed in those days, this is before we had the OSS, there was an espionage system that had a code, and they deciphered a plot to assassinate Woodrow Wilson while he was in Paris. This was at the end of World War I, and they were going to kill him either in Paris or sometime during the Versailles meetings. And the way they were going to kill him was by giving him a slow death by poison. That was their choice. Or they could put an influenza virus into his eyes. There was a large epidemic of influenza in Europe, and many, many people were killed. And they could either put influenza in his ice cubes at the time, this is right after World War I, or cause a slow death by poison. And Major Herbert Yardley said that he wasn't sure what happened to Woodrow Wilson, but in the book he says there's no way of knowing if the plot was successful, except that President Woodrow Wilson got sick while he was in Paris on the Versailles Accords. And then he was soon to die a lingering death. He never fully recovered from the sickness that he had, and he did succumb finally to a lingering death, which nobody, I'm sure, associated with the inclusion or the wish to include Russia into the peace talks or the desire not to rearm Germany, because as soon as the war was over, Reinhard Gehlen, who was a young student in Eastern Europe, went right to Germany and began secretly to set up the rearmament of Germany with a group of other officials. They published textbooks and made armaments and subverted the standard army until Hitler was in power in 1933. So these conspiracies to keep Russia out of peace talks, to not coexist with communists, has been going on for quite a while. And the method of using drugs may be a little more sophisticated, maybe not. We may still be using these viruses and influenza, whether in ice or air conditioning or whatever, but these conspiracies exist. I believe that conspiracies exist. I call my program Dialogue Conspiracy. I talk about certain murders or assassinations, and I believe they're well planned, and I believe they're planned from the highest offices down to the street level. How far do they go? I think they go right up to the top of the president, the head of the FBI, the head of the CIA, the men that formed the OSS, and then the CIA. How extensive? I think they permeate the Supreme Court, the Justice Department, the local police, the investigators, the FBI, certainly the CIA, and they permeate organized crime. That body of persons is used by the government because of their reputation for violence or being hitmen or getting their way through other than lawful means. So the body of our United States government has to appear as if it's acting in a lawful manner, and therefore they employ organized crime, the syndicate, the mafia, whatever name you want to give it. And this is a common method of operation. How many are affected by these murders and cover-up? There's no way of telling yet. If they go from just the assassination of a president or a senator, civil rights leaders, and then they extend into germ warfare or weather control, then we know they affect everybody. They hit all levels of our life, and I'm not really sure that many of the things we're suffering from, these strange diseases and cancers, the increase of cancer and famines and droughts and floodings, aren't related to the same kinds of people who are manipulating large masses of the population. There's a connection between corporate interests and assassinations. Jack Anderson had an article today on the leap of ITT to the top ranks of the industrial international corporations. That was just in the paper today. But ITT got a lot of muscle when Salvador Allende was killed. Nobody was prosecuted in the organization. They influenced Chile, the copper mines, the lifestyle of millions of people, their health, their death, and then they go on to become one of the largest corporations. And I do believe that through every structure of the large multinational corporations are a series of well-planned corpses and manipulations of people, leaders, in order to gain the control that they want. These conspiracies are affecting the minds of some researchers who see one area of conspiracy and can't see another. But maybe someday a body of us, maybe not a large group, but I think of a large number of us right now who are working, who are going to put those links together for you, hopefully within a short period of time, maybe a year or two now, and it won't be difficult. Ed Sanders is an investigative writer who published a book called The Family. It's on the Manson family. I didn't like Ed Sanders' book. He didn't see the areas of conspiracy in the drug operations and the use of Peter Pitch's Sheriff's Department in Los Angeles, the LAPD, NASA, the links of NASA to the killings of, say, of Sharon Tate and the LaBianca murders. Ed Sanders, in those days, was looking more at something occult and mystical, more on the hippie side of the Manson family, and didn't see the higher levels of the conspiracy. He got a book out quickly, and he ignored these levels and just barely touched them. And at that time, I thought it was a poor book. I still do. He could have done more, but it was a book about the Manson family. But now Ed Sanders is into another kind of conspiracy, and he sees that. So maybe someday he'll rewrite The Family with the other hard evidence that he didn't use at the time he wrote his book. Ed Sanders now publishes a paper that you may want. I just got the first issue, number one. Would you believe there's a newsletter coming out just on cattle? It's called The Cattle Report. It's on the mutilation of animals, domestic animals, cattle in 22 states. He claims the mutilators have spent millions of dollars in security and fuel and in support to terrify local ranchers in the West and Midwest. And I have done some shows on the cattle mutilation. The Cattle Report is available, box 729, Woodstock, New York, 12498. It's $6 for 5 issues. I think it's important because he comes to the conclusion that this involves the military, and it does. The United States helicopters are definitely involved in this. It's not UFOs at all. These mutilations, he thinks, involve illegal chemical, biological warfare research, that they're involved in some kind of research, and they're trying to blame the UFOs. And it has to do with the availability of tests to show radiation at the mutilation sites. Now, these things are important because terror was important to the fascist regimes in Germany and Eastern Europe, Yugoslavia, and with the Ustashi in Poland and Romania as soon as the Nazis came in or prior to it. And the evidence of a government link to the cattle mutilations is overwhelming. I have many, many articles, several studies done that were in the Berkeley Barb, and Tom Adams, a very fine researcher, has written in this newsletter. I have it here. And I can go into details for you if you can't afford that $6, or maybe we can get some copies for you. It's called The Cattle Report. It may be that I can reproduce it for you for a dollar, but that's what he's charging, really. It's $6 for 5. issues. And it's important to know that researchers are moving into other fields and seeing patterns now. Maybe his book got out too quickly on the Manson family, but now the cattle mutilation is an important thing to Ed Sanders, who also has been writing about the Robert Kennedy assassination. And I think you should get it if you can, and I'll copy it for you if you can't. The Cattle Report has a lot of information about government hanky-panky. Speaking about that, there were, a few weeks ago, there was an article in the Los Angeles Times that quickly went off the news. It was there for one day about UFO sightings in Los Angeles. And it also mentioned that they were in Salinas. And I didn't get any comments from listeners or anything in our Monterey Herald much about these sightings, but a gentleman who listens to KLRB Dialogue Conspiracy every week sent me a letter, and he told me that he was working a night shift at Spreckles a few weeks ago, 3:30 a.m., and he noted the UFOs, which were reported in Los Angeles, and the Los Angeles Times says that they were seen at Salinas, and he saw them at that time. But what didn't follow, but was in a separate article, was that that same night, 400 to 500, maybe 2,000 sheep were dead at Fort Ord. A private ranch that borders our military installation here at Fort Ord had sheep grazing on the hills, and the same morning after those UFOs were flying over Fort Ord and over Salinas, there were hundreds of sheep just dead. No follow-up, an immediate article saying in the paper, you know, nothing particularly unusual about all these sheep just walking to the ravine and dying that night. But they were over Salinas and Fort Ord. This has been confirmed, and the cattle are dead. And I often wonder what the people think who have these sheep, why they aren't outraged or calling talk shows or writing letters to the editors. But there's this general conspiracy of silence everywhere, of not following things through. They make the headlines once. They're never proven to be wrong, and there's conspiracy of silence. And that's a subject that I want to talk about with you today, because a lot of people who want information on the assassinations to come out, all the information, are getting together. Our phone bills are too high. We send letters back and forth. And we don't have money for a formal newsletter, but we're forming a very loosely knit organization called The Real Researchers. And these are people that don't spend their time putting down the other researchers. We share facts and information. We share cassettes. They get copies of these radio shows on KLRB and duplicate them for many, many other people around the country, and they in turn duplicate it. And we're spreading information around because there is a conspiracy of silence that is deafening going on, and information is not getting out to the American people. Just even isolated facts, much less connections. We have to go into the assumption that the major media isn't going to get any better on this matter. We know that there's information coming out of Nevada, Las Vegas, Nevada, on Howard Hughes, or the Houston Post that isn't in our papers. As I say many times on the air, I take 10 papers a day, and it's like living in 10 different worlds. Each city has its own area of news, and many, many stories aren't carried over the wire service, so you're not getting them anywhere else. And it's a very scary thing because it's very hard for people to put these facts together if they don't get a list of information and come to their own conclusions, and they're isolated on single facts. There are a group of people in Pennsylvania, New York, and Florida, and Washington who want to get information together, and we want to know why the accepted researchers are blocking these facts that we know are true. The accepted researchers, I mentioned Mark Lane, and I want to go into a conversation I had with Harold Weisberg, who wrote 4 books on the Kennedy assassination. I talked with him this week, and I couldn't believe the things that he was telling me. I know Harold was in the OSS, and he was in the FBI, and I don't know whether he is senile or whether he's still in the intelligence community. He can't be stupid. He's done too much work. And his excuse for some of his opinions was that he only gets 6 hours sleep and he's 64 years old. I can't believe that's a legitimate excuse for some of the shocking things Harold was saying to me. And yet I know that there's information out on these conspiracies that he will not use, that he will not accept, whether it's from me or Penn Jones or Ted Gandolfo or John Judge or David Miller. There are certain people who have information that is factual, and the leaders, so-called leaders, at least have books published or in the media, refuse to accept these facts. And it's getting so serious that we have to keep asking ourselves, why are they doing this? I noticed at first at the conspiracy conference in Boston in 1975, where Robert Salant's information on the Wallace shooting was not accepted by the so-called known researchers, why Ted Chiarock's movie, The Second Gun, was pushed aside, not on the basis of the evidence, but there was this wall of silence. And it goes back again to certain people like Sylvia Marr, who wrote Accessories After the Fact, and she also wrote a subject index of the Warren Commission hearings. And I just looked up that index today. Certain names that are left out of her book can't be coincidental, because she did a subject index of names of the 26 volumes. She has volume 10, page 21. Certain names are in there, but she leaves out names such as Robert Morris, who was one of the founders of Young American Freedom, who's still active with people in Congress today, the extreme right wing, and the YAF organization, Tom Charles Houston. They didn't stop their right wing efforts or their links to the potential assassins in 1963. It's 1977, and they're still active. She didn't, in her index, use the name of Robert Morris, of Colonel Lawrence Orloff, of Warren Carroll of the CIA, the link of H.L. Hunt, the oilman, to Jack Ruby. She didn't mention Clyde Moore. She never brought up Howard Hughes' name, even though it was in the testimony of Jean de Morenchild that she was brought here by her brother who worked for Hughes. There's no mention of Lockheed, even though that corporation's name is in the 26 volumes, or Frank McGee from Dallas, or Dale Davenport, or Norman Baker, Bill Burley, Volkmar Schmidt, who worked for General Walker. She did have in her index Bill Burley, right-winger, Commission Exhibit 1811, and had no more references to when his name is mentioned or the importance of Bill Burley. As I say, she doesn't have the YAF, the Young Americans for Freedom, in there, or an Art Francewald, or Ken Glazebrook, or Larry Jones, the Republic National Bank, which was acknowledged as a CIA black money funding source for killing, where Connie Trammell worked and where Larry Schmidt went for deposits, where money was available for the extreme right-wing military intelligence that came from Germany, or Richard Harsh and Sheila McDonald, James Mosley, Richard Marks, the cashier of the Republic National Bank. How come these names are left out of a subject index? The links to the oil people and the CIA and the CIA banks that did counterintelligence in volume 23. There's evidence in volume 18 of who these people were, what they were doing. There were letters back and forth. Bill and Norman, that's Bill Burley and Norman Davenport, get here. The sooner the better. This was a letter sent out in July 63, and John Kennedy's coming November. They said Sheila McDonald will be here in August. Ken Glazberg will be here in September. That will give you a fine team and working force. We want to get Norman Baker into the Republic National Bank. We are building credit like crazy for the day we're going to need instant cash. We're storing up on insurance collateral for that day. We will net $400 to $500 a month. Our organization will be in operation, and it includes Warren Carroll. This is of the CIA. There are other documents there. Warren, that's Warren Carroll, the CIA, and Larry Schmidt get along beautifully. Warren has a PhD from Columbia, two masters from Colorado. He's going to law school. He's doing the legal work for us. He's the personal writer for H.L. Hunt, the oil millionaire, the richest man in Texas. Hunt contributed $1,000 to our organization thanks to Warren Carroll, to the YAF. These letters are in the 26 volumes. How do they go to the bank and get credit, how they're getting salary, and yet they're not in the index. Here's one, volume 18, page 858. Ken Glazebrook is in Yugoslavia. He'll be in Middle East all month before he arrives in Dallas. You will get what Larry got when he arrives here. You'll get a week-long briefing. These are letters to Munich, Germany, that these men have to be in Dallas in November, and their names aren't in the subject index. Arrangements have been made to meet the head of the Dallas John Birch Society, and also General Walker and H.L. Hunt. This is volume 18, page 851. Larry Schmidt wrote to Bernard Weissman. This is volume 18, page 837. You better get out here to Dallas from Germany as fast as you can. It's not a decision of whether you can do better financially or elsewhere or rewarded here. It is a decision of whether to honor your oath to sacrifice for your country. Kennedy is scheduled in Dallas on November 24th. Arrangements are very delicate. I have worked with Dale Davenport, the chairman of YAF. If I don't produce the bodies, Dallas is just liable to think me a phony and say, forget it. P.S. My brother began working as an aide to General Walker. He's being paid full time. Another letter said, my mission in Dallas has been accomplished. We are in. Friday, I met with Dr. Robert Morris, president of the Defenders of American Liberty, and Clyde Moore, former public relations man for Hunt, Mr. H.L. Hunt, and he's a former UPI news writer, and Kim Thompson. We met with him from the Dallas Morning News. I got immediate backing from Morris, Kubik, Woods, and Ellis. These letters go on about military intelligence, about these men getting money and having availability at the bank, at the Republic National Bank, and yet they're not in the subject index. I could go on and on, and I have done some shows on the military intelligence that worked with H.L. Hunt, the oilman, and with Republic National Bank of the CIA that has been recognized for their kill money, and these men coming from Munich, Germany, to be there, and they had the dates when John Kennedy would be there. It was off 2 days, but when they're planning this as far ahead as a year, in 1962, November 24th, doesn't mean a thing. That's the day that Lee Harvey Oswald was killed, and maybe that was the final part of their plan. Well, I called Harold Weisberg because he had talked to another researcher, Ted Gandolfo, and told Ted there was no link of the Watergate men to the Kennedy assassination, and that George de Morenchil, the gentleman that was killed down in Florida, was not an important part of the Kennedy assassination conspiracy. And it was very hard for me to believe after all these years that he couldn't find the links of George de Morenchil to the part of framing Lee Harvey Oswald, to introducing him to the job, the photographic lab, where he worked and then did jobs for the company that planned the motorcade, or introducing him to Ruth Payne, who got him the job in the book depository. I called Harold on the phone, and he said, I'll quote you directly, I took from the taping of the telephone conversation, he said, I have no reason to connect any Watergate defendants to the Kennedy assassination, not E. Howard Hunt, not Bernard Barker, not Frank Fiorini, that's Frank Sturgis. He says there's no evidence to connect them at all. The FBI spoke to 1,000 Fiorinis, and just because the FBI had an interview with Frank Sturgis the day after Kennedy was killed in Florida, and Sturgis was giving out information that Oswald was a communist, and this was misinformation, Harold Weisberg didn't think this was important. Now, I bring up what he is saying, or what Sylvia Marr left out, or what Mark Lane isn't doing, because the term, the real researchers, is important, and I want you to understand, if you are interested in joining a LoosNet organization and getting on a mailing list, you let me know. If you want to help with research, let me know. We have to counteract these people because they're not telling the truth. They're not keeping their eyes open. And it's too late in the game for them to influence the congressional investigations back there or to influence any young researchers that are coming along. He went on to say that you could go back to conspiracies as far as Jesus Christ if you wanted connections. And I agreed that that was a conspiracy too, the Last Supper and the planning of killing of Christ. Harold Weisberg said to me that George de Morenchil is not important. He said in quotes, I believe he was CIA, this is Lee Harvey Oswald's contact in the Dallas area, in the way that thousands of people are, in the way every intelligence agency works, but there's no connection to the Kennedy assassination. And I went on to say that de Morenchil was the most important witness of the entire group. And he said de Morenchil wasn't important. I reminded him that the only person present, except for a historian from the Pentagon, when George de Morenchil testified, was the attorney for the Warren Commission, Albert Jenner, who also was the attorney for Henry Crown of General Dynamics. They made the F-111s. And the General Dynamics Chief of Security, Max Clark, in the Dallas-Fort Worth area where the planes were made, was the very first person that Lee Harvey Oswald was to see after he went to a stenographer with notes typed up on the Soviet Union, and the stenographer said she believed he was an agent and he was taking these to an engineer. Max Clark had been an engineer. It's unfortunate that a man of Harold Weisberg's stature can't see these connections, and I also reiterate he was in the OSS and he was in the FBI. And then he went on to say, after I reminded him that de Morenchil got Lee Harvey Oswald the job at this photographic lab that works for the CIA and does government bonds and maps of Chile and other important government printing they do with security clearances there. He said, well, I got Bob Castor a job. What does that make of me? Bob Castor is a very close friend of General Walker's, whose name has come out by various researchers. And I said, I don't know what it makes of you. Tell me what kind of job you got me, and I'll tell you what you're doing. And he said, I won't tell you where I got my job. It doesn't make anything of me if I get a man who's suspected of being involved in the assassination and working with General Walker. If I got him a job, it has nothing to do with his matter at all. I haven't seen him for a couple of years. And he said, it's meaningless. It doesn't depend on anything. And I said, where you can procure a job, how you can get a job for somebody is important. If you got him a job at a grocery store as a clerk or a bank teller, if you have a friend who's a president of the bank, that's one thing. If he's working in intelligence or with the CIA, of course it matters where he gets a job. It would explain to me why you can't get into new material and move on and get the facts before the American people. He also told me that nobody knew that Kennedy was coming to Dallas far in advance, that no conspiracy of plans could lay far in advance. And that's not true. You see, those letters that were in the volume 15, volume 18, they knew when Kennedy was coming. These were written in June, July. They're making contacts in 1962. And John Kennedy didn't get there until 1963. And anybody who knew the electoral process in this country knew that the Democrats needed those 32 electoral votes from Texas, and the Democratic Party was split. And eventually John Kennedy had to win that to win the election, and he had to go down there and campaign. Harold Weisberg said, as I say, repeat before, he says, I just had my 64th birthday. I only get 6 hours sleep, so I haven't got time to engage in theories. And getting back to the conspiracy, I remind him of Reinhard Gehlen's work to subvert Western Europe into a total fascism that began in 1919 and is still, I think, going on. And he says, you'd go crazy weaving all these connections together that way. And I don't believe it. I don't think a person would go crazy seeing the links, say, of killing Woodrow Wilson or stopping the peace talks of General Eisenhower when the U-2 was brought down and when Gary Powers believes there was a conspiracy to down him and suggests that Lee Harvey Oswald could have done it. Whether John Kennedy was killed and papers are forged to say that he ordered the murder of Diem after Kennedy was dead, and E. Howard Hunt, who's infamous for all these years, is forging these documents to rewrite history. You can go through 1,000 pieces of conspiracy and hoaxes that are going on, and the names all link and the people link, the breaking up d'entente. Later with Madame Chenault breaking it up when Lyndon Johnson got out of office and wanted peace in Southeast Asia was sabotaged, or the SALT talks being sabotaged now by Jimmy Carter. This has been going on since the end of World War I, and I think you can weave these pieces together, and it's getting easier to weave them together. And there are good people all around the country who are trying to put the pieces together. And Harold Weisberg is unfortunate at his age of life when he is, you know, tired and working hard, and he's holding the line. There's no conspiracy with the Watergate defendants. There was no conspiracy with the Morenschild. He's trying to hold the line at a certain level of a crossfire and sticking with that evidence without asking who gained, who lost, who's suppressing. And that's tragic because he has books out, and what he has in the books are good. But he is suffering, or he's part of disinformation or discrediting. As I say, I don't know whether he still works with the agencies or he's senile. He does have good books. I asked him, didn't he think it was strange that Walter Dornberger, one of Hitler's rocket space engineers that worked with Wernher von Braun in a conspiracy, ends up out of Bell Aerospace, and Lee Harvey Oswald's host, Marine Oswald's host, Michael Payne, works with Nazi criminal Dornberger. And Harold Weisberg said, I think the fact that Dornberger and Michael Payne are working together has no relationship to each other. I think individually it has significance. It's significant that Michael Payne had a job with Bell Aerospace when Lee Harvey Oswald was staying at the house and when both had security clearances, one currently, Michael Payne had and Oswald had through the service. But he said this has no connection with Reinhard Gehlen, even though Reinhard Gehlen was given $200 million for the CIA by Alan Dulles and brought his agents into this country. I think it's unfortunate because not only did Lee Harvey Oswald stay at the home and visit with Ruth and Michael Payne, and Michael worked for war criminal Dornberger at Bell Aerospace, but when Lee Harvey Oswald left the Dallas area and went to New Orleans in April of 1963, he went to another interesting job for Riley Coffee Company. He worked for William B. Riley Coffee Company from May until July 1963 in the New Orleans area. And while he was there, he worked with agents who then went on to work with Wernher von Braun, the head of our space program. Von Braun and Dornberger were had these rocket factories that were named as using slave labor skeletons, part of genocide programs in Germany. Dornberger went on and formed NASA in the United States at Muscle Shoals, Alabama. And his co-partner Dornberger had Bell Aerospace. Lee Harvey Oswald's host worked for Dornberger in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, and then Oswald went to New Orleans to Riley. At Riley Coffee Company, the man who hired him was named Alfred Claude, C-L-A-U-D-E. Claude went on, after he hired Oswald at the coffee company, to work for the Chrysler Aerospace, which was part of NASA. The same month that Lee Harvey Oswald left his job at Riley, he went on to Chrysler Aerospace. And Emmett Barbie, who is Oswald's immediate supervisor at Riley Coffee Company, left the coffee business when Lee Harvey Oswald left and went to the National Aeronautics and Space Administration. That's NASA, when Oswald was there. Remember, Oswald worked from April. He went down May 63, July 63 at Riley Coffee Company. And Alfred Claude, who hired him, went on to work for NASA under the Chrysler Aerospace Company. And Emmett Barbie, his supervisor, left the coffee business and went on to work for NASA. And a few weeks later, Oswald's workmate, John D. Branyon, B-R-A-N-Y-O-N, went to work for NASA also. And another co-worker left to join the Chrysler Aerospace Division, a NASA contractor. There were four of them. So any one of these men could have given testimony about Lee Harvey Oswald at the Riley Coffee Company, but only one of them was called as a witness. This information about Riley comes from Sybil Leek's book, The Assassination Chain, page 75 and 76, for those of you that keep track of William Riley, because he, in turn, was funded by Mullen Associates, William Riley, and that's the office in Washington, D.C., where E. Howard Hunt and John Mitchell and the Watergate defendants planned their operations for the 1972 elections to sabotage those elections, which eventually got Richard Nixon out of office. Lee Harvey Oswald told a friend when he worked at Riley that he'd like to work for NASA, and he might have been promised a job to NASA, and you can see how hard that would be to infiltrate if he were actually sympathetic to the Soviet Union, which he never was. He was always linked to the intelligence community. So when people say that there was not a plot of Lee Harvey Oswald with George de Morenschild with his contacts in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, when they leave out the NASA and the Dornberger Bell Aerospace links and the Jagger's Chili Stovall job of Lee Harvey Oswald, they are in error. There was a conspiracy. There's a new issue coming out. It wasn't last week. It's going to be this week in midnight, my article on George de Morenschild. And if you buy the National Enquirer, there's an article by A.J. Weberman, who wrote Coup d'etat, also on George de Morenschild. And he told me today that he has documents now that were turned over to Marguerite Oswald about Lee Harvey Oswald in the Soviet Union. And when she wrote Lee Harvey Oswald letters, the CIA took her letters and put a dot over the letter and micro-dotted it, which was what Lee Harvey Oswald was doing at a printing plant he was able to do in the United States. So she could send a letter to her son. The government took the letter before it reached him. They put a micro dot. You can take that micro dot and blow it up, and it can be the entire page of a newspaper. They can be spy instructions. They could be documents. They could be instructions on Gary Powers' U-2 flight. So that the family letters that Lee Harvey Oswald was sending to his family, or they were sending to him, were intercepted by the Central Intelligence Agency with dots, and they used these letters to send spy messages to Lee Harvey Oswald. These documents were just turned over to Marguerite Oswald, and they will be printed in the National Enquirer this week, so be sure to get the National Enquirer. Well, there are a group of hard researchers working. We will continue to get information to you. I've overrun my time. This is Mae Brussel, and it's Dialogue Conspiracy, Carmel, California. I'll see you next week, and stay well until then.
There is a truth, I thought to myself, while driving down Route 68. The car in front is a Renault, it's not behind, it's not a Ford. There is a truth in how things happen. If it was yesterday, it wasn't 1894. And if tomorrow's gonna too come true, there'll be another truth in store. And those who think there is no truth, that all depends on point of view, will lock us up and fire the bombs made only for a gentleman to use. The president is just a choice. He should not incite or claim his fame. One November night I heard the screaming horns. A new America had changed her name. We're not the same. You and I are not. You who called free thinkers enemies, you are clearly now the enemies. And we will do what we must do to keep it free. Like I must write and she must sing and they must slave. You must have heard that we will never really rise again. The minds behind the plastic bugles gave the word that they cannot just mow us down. It's they who are the arch-anemic ones. Ours are free and tender girls. Ours are mountain climbing sons. So you and I who disagree that truth exists but misery, I cry for you, I cry for us as I prepare to leave the bus. There is a truth for you and me. Feast our eyes upon and see. The sun is true, but for the blind. And we are free, but for our minds. There is a truth.